So good evening, everybody, and good evening, Mr. Hodgkinson, and welcome to the stage. Your timing is absolutely perfect. Fantastic. Come on up. Do you know, on the schedule, this session is really said to be a panel discussion, and here we have the four of us up here, and the group is smaller and more intimate. And what I'd really like to do is have the opportunity to go into as much depth as you like over this next hour. Any questions that you have? I know the gentleman there has a question. I promised that we would give you that, and you will be the first to ask a question. And then we can maybe just go into any detail that you would like, if you have any questions, or you may have some comments that you might like to make, and that we can listen to, and just really have a conversation about spiritual things and about maybe about next steps, because you know we all met at least once out there in India, in your respective cities, and we've met now here in this retreat center. Is that it? Do we never see you again? What happens? So, you know, maybe we can think about the future of power in your lives. So let's begin with the gentleman now, Sriram. Do you have, Sriram, are you there? Do you have, oh, Sriram. Do you have a...
It looks like in the deep of the woods.
Hello. Can I have a microphone in the audience, please?
Can we have them come closer?
Yes,
a little
you
bit?
May. You please be welcome to come and sit close. And in fact, if you were very close, we could take all the seats and go down there.
Yes.
And be in much more like a conversation. Shall we do that? Is that a good idea?
Let's first see how many turn up, Anthony. The first line is not reserved for VIPs, so you can all come forward. You are VIPs.
Yeah. So what do you think?
No, I think it's okay.
All right? Okay. Yeah. As they say, ow, 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 ow.
Ow.
Ow, ow, ow. I would say it sounds like someone's in pain, but of course, you know, I'm English.
But that's ouch, and this is ow.
Ow.
Anthony, you're not given chance to debate today all day.
Well, we're going to...
Waiting, Anthony will give me a chance to music.
Well, he did it, I gave him a minute, you know.
You were missed you here, it. You
were
missed
you here? Were you here for Amrit Vela? Did you get up for Amrit Vela? Well, if you had, he plays the most beautiful, I mean, he plays all the instruments, but right at the beginning, he played a wooden flute, and then at the end, he played the metal flute, and in the middle, he played the recorder, and it was absolutely fantastic. I find it very difficult not to just close my eyes and float away. But we've been told that we have to keep our eyes open, so... And stay present, yeah. So, okay, I'd like to give the gentleman that... So, Sriram, can we have the... Sriram, can we have the microphone for this gentleman here? And do you remember last night I was very tough on you? I wouldn't let you speak. And now the floor is yours.
But I agree with you. Maybe I could make my question more stronger.
Okay.
This time so that I can have more discussion with you. Maybe I should ask one question. That as a principal of a school, and even there are many of the parents here, and talking to their children, we are just told, as we have learned from you, that we should talk from soul to soul. Means that a young soul, which I have to get him best out of him. But we find the children not obeying their parents at many of the extent. And then we do convey to the parents that your child is your responsibility, you are a caretaker. You cannot force him to the extent. But parents have some dreams. So they always want the child to come up. And if the child doesn't fill up what they want, then they reach to some large extent, violent extent. So to what extent the parent should become strict, taking him as a young soul and also taking him as a caretaker? Please
okay.
Convey.
Okay, great. So, well, I tell you what, Neville, I'm going to feel that one to you. And the reason I'm going to do that, you should know, is that Neville's son has just written a book about his childhood with Neville as his father, obviously, when he first came into this spiritual context. And I know Neville has a huge amount of experience and probably some sort of different angle on what you're talking about.
I remember that one of the things that happened, because it was halfway through the children's childhood with two sons, and they were 11 and 12 when I came into this knowledge and practice. And it did make a big impact on the home, because there were many discussions. And I've seen how both boys have taken that in and joined their careers and relationships. A lot of the wisdom proved to be of value to them. Neither of them wanted to take up BK lifestyle as such, but I can see how valuable it was to them to have been exposed to these understandings. But the biggest change I remember was that instead of seeing them subconsciously as extensions of myself, you know, often a parent sees their child as like an extension of themselves. Grandparents are even more liable to do this, like to see a grandchild as their line into the future, you know. It's a kind of, it's deep inside us, but it's not, it doesn't come from soul awareness. It comes from what we called it in general terms, body consciousness. You know, when you're thinking that you are a body and that this kind of carrier of your genes is your line into the future. And there's a sense of ownership, which is, it seems natural to people, but actually it carries some disadvantages. Because when people feel that their child is theirs, then let's say the parent has certain expectations and the child doesn't fulfill them, the parent gets much more upset, and let's say the child doesn't get the grades that the parents hoped for. Instead of just supporting the child and seeing if they can do better in, or some other direction, instead of that, if the parent is very upset, you've let down the family name, you know, this kind of thing, it's very bad for that child. It can damage their whole life. I've seen this happen. So whereas in that first part of their childhood, I saw my sons as like extensions of myself, and we had good fun together, but the change that happened was that I saw them more as individuals in their own right. Of course, they were still children. They still needed guidance. I was probably too, too liberal with them, actually, because I lost confidence in myself in a way for a while after when I started this spiritual study, because it was such a big change for me that I was like a butterfly who'd become a caterpillar who'd become a chrysalis. So there was a little while it was a bit confusing for the household. But definitely the parent needs to continue their sense of responsibility, but towards that person as a quite separate individual, not that this is part of me going into the future. And I remember very clearly that we were in a position, because of both earning well at that time, to choose their schools, you know, to have private education for them. And that led to some really good decisions, so that we chose, for one, schooling that was right for that individual, and quite different schooling for the other one. And that was a wonderful advantage for them both. So that's one aspect of it that I see. Just the only other thing to remember is that I remember that Brahma Baba spoke about this sometimes, when parents said, Baba, the children behave so badly and I just want to hit them. What should I do? And Baba said, if you hit them, you're teaching them violence. So don't hit them, but you can restrain them and you can, you know, you can tie them to a table or something if they're really being crazy. He used some expression like this. That's not unkind. You might have to do that to really get your point across. Sounds bad to our Western standards, tie someone to a table, but it's better than losing your temper. And that kind of, I think he said that you could deprive them of a meal or something that they loved for a while to bring home the point that their behaviour was unacceptable, but not to set them an example of violence by hitting them.
Doctor. Do we have a microphone? Yeah, back there. Yeah, here we go.
I've lately been working with the young students, and especially from 9th class to 12th class, as part of my passion of or joy of giving back. So what I have observed is this, that the Indian society's psyche, especially of the children, is very much different than what it used to be. So it is better if we make them understand what are the possibilities where they can lead themselves in their life and be more friendly with them, more companionship, and travel with them rather than forcing the things on them, because they just become, they just reject those offers, and it works very well because the parents are now, Indian parents are working most of the time, both the parents are working. So the child, when the child comes home, the child is alone with some nanny or some family members. So the best thing is this, that they should give time, and also they should, because we are connected, we know our children and grandchildren have been visiting Kanpur Center, Brahma Kumari Center, very regular, and so that has made a good difference. So it should be made a way of life, so that nothing is forced on them.
Just reaffirm that we have a similar tendency generationally with young people in England too, and what you said makes 100% sense. I think it's a really, really good point.
So, yeah, okay, right, so, General, would you like to make a comment, and then behind you, sir, yeah?
Allow me to leave some thoughts with you.
Yeah.
Because certain things are the same through the ages. And I start with the Battle of Mahabharata. And the person deemed to be responsible for it is Duryodhan. And this famous lament of Duryodhan has come to us through the ages. He says, I know what is right, but my mind turns away from it. I know what is wrong, but I'm hugely attracted to it. That is the dilemma of the ages. It comes again and again and again. Similarly, that comment made, which is very famous, the biblical comment almost, not biblical after, Saint Augustine. He says, O Lord, save me from temptation, but not yet. Yeah, is there?
Yeah.
So, this is all right. We had centuries and millennia before. Now the time has come that we don't have the leisure, not yet. It has to be immediate.
Yeah.
Third thing, there was a comment today and questions were asked when somebody said heart, dil se. And you know, somebody said that earlier on what was told was that it is here, the mind, etc. We don't have to take the intellectualization or the semantics part of it, the philosophy of things, too far. Sometime you have to, the advice that's come to us through the ages, we are going to respect that. When somebody comes, you know, you have it in your UK also, oh, I saw him, you warmed the cockles of my heart. It's there. And it's accepted. And one more, Mahatma Gandhi. All the war colleges in the world, here's the general here who's been with the UN, and I've been around the world and I've been to many war colleges. You have Sun Tzu and you have Jomini and such writers of military history. In our war college, in Mao, which they call now the College of Combat, there's just a small, pithy caption of Mahatma Gandhi. And what he has said is, the only tyrant I obey is that little voice in my heart. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Those are great thoughts. Very good. And sir, behind there, that's great. Yeah. Yeah, for you, yeah, yeah. That's you, you're on.
Yeah. this question is addressed to Nizar Bhai. And would you share some experience of once having learned or decided to get into spiritualism, how did you spread it amongst your corporate colleagues? would you like to give any advice or share your experience which we could use and would be helpful to us?
When I first got into this knowledge, it was not like magic for me. It wasn't like I adopted it in 1 minute. Because I hear lots of people say they took the knowledge and then, presto, like magic, they were able to adopt it. So for me, it was a process. I have a planning intellect, so I planned everything. And I researched things, and I went to lots of centers. So there was a period of between 2 or 3 years when I began to live a schizophrenic life. So I had a life of my existing religion. I had a life from my existing friends. I had a life for the Brahma Kumaris. And I had a corporate life. And I tried very hard to keep all of those separate. So it wasn't like I was going out into the world and saying, hey, I am this or I am that. So I think that it took some time for me first to adopt it. And once I was really, really sure that this was the path that I was going to take, until that I was quite scared to admit to serious corporate people that I was doing something which was related to religion or spirituality or meditation or some such. Because in those days, and I'm talking 23 years ago, 24 years ago, spirituality was not something that was accepted as being normal. I think today, more and more, people accept this, that yes, you can be a serious business person or an industrialist or head of whatever and still be spiritual. Because in those days, they used to say, are you serious about your business if you are following also the spiritual path? Because in those days it was like spirituality is for women and old people, not for serious business people. It's true. I think people like me and Anthony and Neville and so on are going out into the world and making it to be normal. We call it demystifying spiritualism or demystifying even the Brahma Kumaris. So it was steps like that that we took. So in the beginning, we were not so open about it. I was not so open. But I think that as it went past, I had to change my social life. I had to bring in lots of changes in my routine because I didn't eat non-vegetarian food, I didn't drink alcohol, I stopped smoking, I stopped going to evening parties. So after a little while it became obvious that I was doing something which was not normal. But I think that as it became known that I was serious, then people started to accept this very easily, and lots of people would then come to me when they wanted to have a quiet word of advice or quiet, they had a problem that they wanted to come and discuss with me. So I think that what I'm trying to say is that it was a different world then. It was not so open as it is now. Today, everybody knows the path that I'm taking and everybody respects that. And nobody ever says to me anymore, come on, have a drink, because they know it's not something I do. And I think that the effect of that slowly began to be very serious. And people realized that as I became more and more spiritual, in their words, I also did not let go of what I was doing in the corporate world. I was more successful. I was less angry. I had less stress. And consequently, you know, I expanded from probably 10, 12 companies, I don't remember exactly, to now I have more than 70. So they realized that I was able to do all of that well, and still I was on an even keel. So I think people wanted to know that more and more. How do you do it? What is the way to do it? So I think that it takes time, but eventually the result of your practical spirituality, people then want to get involved and know more and more about it. Is that the sort of thing that you wanted to talk to me about? Or is it something more than...
Yeah, I think it gives quite a bit of insight into what I wanted to know. I think my next question would be, for myself, not really for this panel, what do I decide to do? You said you had a schizophrenic lifestyle, and I think some of us already have it. Already. You talked about four, and I think maybe we have three or four or five or something of that sort. That's what we keep on doing. Now, I think the question which each one of us would have to answer, or at least I would have to answer, is how do I decide to go on that path? How much time would I take? And what do I see as the outcome? Or how am I able to discipline myself to that extent? Thank you. I have another small bit. Again, to the corporate sector. First of all, you say that the bottom line is important. Your financial results on quarter to quarter are important. You are ultimately responsible as a corporate head to the stakeholder. The stakeholder only understands the profitability or the dividend part of it. And now, most of the Indian business schools, the top ones, the IIM, the ISB and all, have started talking about ethical standards or ethics. And I come from Lucknow, where there's an IIM, and I've had an occasion to talk about ethics to the management students over there. But I find that the concept of ethics is far, far away from the spirituality, what we understand or what it is. And probably ethics alone is not the answer to what people are trying to really search for. And it is spirituality. But if one were to talk of spirituality in a business school, next time they'd stop inviting you and think you have gone crazy.
But not anymore, if I may continue. No, it's not so anymore. Ajit Ranganekar, who is the CEO of the Indian School of Business in Hyderabad, came to our first program, the FOP, in 2009, November. And he wanted to make spirituality part of the curriculum of the business school in Hyderabad. We did not have the language. He was looking for how can he implement what he wanted, because we didn't have books, we didn't know how to, you remember Ajit Rangan, we didn't know how to present that to him and give him a curriculum. You know, now it exists. Lots of universities in India have adopted spirituality as part of their curriculum. That's the first part. So acceptability is almost universal. You know, one of the things that I had asked Neville to do this time, but we didn't have time, was also to talk about what's happening with spirituality worldwide. You know, in Davos, for example, it exists now. In Harvard, this is the favorite pastime of everybody of learning how to meditate and so on. The other thing that you are saying about adopting spirituality as part of running your businesses, this is absolutely valid. This is what I do. This is what I do and all the CEOs that work for our companies do. We do not give a single penny in bribes, and not a single person working for us will accept it without offering himself for gross misconduct. He will be fired. So we'd absolutely take that into account. That's part of our spiritual way in which to run business. And my own businesses, as well as the businesses that I am chairman of for the Arkhan Foundation. Yes, the bottom line is important, but the bottom line is something we get judged by. It's not our only God. We have various other things on top before we come to money. You see, you can only be judged by money. How else are you judged? Some of the companies that I chair are public corporations, which have shareholders, thousands of shareholders. So they must get their dividend and they must value us based on what the share prices are. And what the bottom line is decides that. So we have to have that. But before that, there are lots of other things, and integrity is one of the things which is right on the top. We would rather not do a business in which we have to do things which are not with integrity than to run a business without it. So I think that that has become very, very important for us. And a lot of people come and say to me, in a corrupt country like India, it's very difficult to do it. I promise you, the countries that we work in are considerably more corrupt than India, if it's possible to say that, but it is. And everything that we do, we are in the top 25% of what we, where we stand. So it's not like we are at the bottom because we are not resorting to bribery and corruption. I'm just giving you one example of the integrity issues that we are using. So if you say, is that spirituality? My answer is absolutely yes. Absolutely it is. Because integrity is part of the values by which we put ourselves in the front and say, we will be judged by this. And I hold very strongly to that. I think that that is part of my learnings, which I'm putting into operation in my everyday life. And that is part of my saying, I belong to your world, which is the corporate world, and I am judged by whatever are the standards of the corporate world, and yet I do everything in a spiritual way.
So, yeah, over here, great. And General, you'd like... Sure.
Hello. This is Jagdish Malu. Continuing to the spirituality part in the management education, I talk about the other perspective from the student's point of life. I graduated postgraduate MBA from India's top five institute called SPJ Institute of Management Research. In their particular curriculum, every 6 months, they used to take us to a camp near Baroda. We were 3 days in that Guruji's camp, and he made us practice meditation at early 5 a.m. and then he related management to Mahabharata. This was 3 day camp in for every day. They are adopting from last 2000. The SPJN is doing this thing, and yearly we have one social project to do, wherein they say that if you are part of social work also, that makes you a better professional and a businessman. In fact, that education made us to become a president of Rotary Sun City, Gulbarga today. I'm a president with those education, and we practice meditation also that time.
Yeah.
So this is the SPJ, Dhawan in Bombay.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. General, you had some comments, yeah.
Hindi or English?
Well, let's have a vote. Do we have any translation? Nitu, do we have? No. Well, I vote English. The chances are, if you speak English and you have a question, one of us should be able to answer. If you speak Hindi, only Nizar is going to answer.
thank you. Firstly, I'm most grateful that an important topic like this, future of power, that is actually the reason for which we are here. And I seek some more light on two spiritual issues first, and then on future of power as such. In our teaching, the Guru has a very important place in one's quest for knowledge. In Raja Yoga, if I understood it correctly, you can directly connect with the superior being, that is Paramatma. So what is the role of Guru in Raja Yoga? That's one. Two, pain. Partly answered this morning, the soul resides in our forehead, but we inflict pain on the body and it is felt intellectually, physically and mentally. So how does the soul which is residing there feel this phenomena, and how can we overcome pain? Now in the context of future of power, my reading tells me power has three main pillars: political, economic and spiritual, and three more pillars that I can add, subsidiary pillars, like social cohesion, knowledge. It is well said in our teaching that even if the enemy has got something good by way of knowledge, you should pick it up and not feel embarrassed by it. And in the context of spiritual knowledge, our worthies of the past say, shed your ego. Now, 65% of clashes today in the world, or differences in the world, are because of differences in ideology. So we who are being prepared to receive this power in the future cannot ignore the challenges which have been cropping up since you took up this very important subject, which has great strategic importance for India. You now confront challenges like terrorism, climate change, ideology, radicalism, increased violence, gender issues, violation of human rights. I can go on. And in the context, the UN has enacted the special development goals in September this year. So, sir, my question in part 3 is leading to, are we sufficiently prepared to act as individuals? Do we realize the cross-cutting issues? And third, can we do better as a group? And if so, how?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
I'll stop there. That's great. So in order to rationally answer that, I'm going to divide it up. Morni, could you first answer the question about Guru? And before you do that, be prepared, Nev, you're on pain. And you, Nizar, power. Go.
Where are the horses?
So I think we've seen that the situation that sometimes arises with gurus is that they don't always live up to what we expect. Like so many gurus now, as you know, very big ones, have completely discredited themselves. And often, people are following blindly. You know, even like these suicide cults. I mean, sometimes you wonder how people could just go along with something like that. So the whole process of Raj Yoga is empowering the self, but also having that direct connection, because what Sister Shivani was talking so much about was relationship. So if I wanted a relationship with anyone, if I went through another person, as she was saying herself, then what kind of a relationship would that be? A relationship needs to be personal and very individual and as intimate as possible. And so this is why we're developing this very close and intimate relationship. And I think that's what many of us enjoy so much, that very, very personal, intimate relationship that we develop with God. Does that answer the guru part?
Pain.
If I may, I'd just like to add something to what Morni said on the on the guru front, that recently I was writing a book about Daddy Janki's teachings. Daddy Janki, of course, now the current head, but I studied under her for about 30 years in London. And she always pays tribute to what happened with Brahma Baba. And the distinction, we say we don't have a guru, but the distinction is a fine one. The book that I wrote is in three sections, birth, life and death. And in effect, she says that she was searching in her childhood. She had small amount of formal education. Her father took her to meet many gurus. She couldn't find what she felt was truth. And she had known Brahma Baba from earlier years as a distinguished businessman in her community. But something happened to him that brought light, and the way that that founding community interpreted it was that the Supreme Soul was working through Brahma Baba to bring these teachings and to bring the understandings that led him to sell his business and give it all in trust to the young women who became today's daddies, you know, who carried this right across the world from very, very small start. So she pays tribute all the time, actually, to Brahma Baba as having been the vehicle that allowed her to recognize God. And I would say the same, not so much from Brahma Baba, because I never met him, although I listened to the Murli, which is, you know, the last few years of his life, his discourses were kept. And I've listened to them for 30 years, and through that I've sort of learned a lot about him and his own work for connecting to the Supreme. So it's definitely not that the Brahma Kumaris say, right, you know, you're a child of God, just connect to God, that's that. It's not like that. In a sense, that master-pupil relationship is there. And that is also very necessary for removing the ego that you mention. Because the ego, as I see it, is this limited sense of self that has been programmed into our brains, like, you know, from my current roles. And that I'm a journalist, I'm a grandpa, I'm a spiritual, I'm a BK, even that could be part of my ego. It's not that it's bad, but if you believe in that to the exclusion of your spiritual self, then it's a complete block to knowing God. So just wanted to add that they, both Daddy Janki and Brahma Baba always paid, Brahma Baba very much saying, look, understand God through me, Daddy Janki saying, I've understood God through Brahma Baba, and she tried to do for us, who never met Brahma Baba, what Brahma Baba had done for them. So in a sense it connects to that tradition that you spoke of. And just briefly on pain, it's useful to distinguish between pain and suffering. Pain is a signal that the body gives you. You know, you put your finger in a flame, a healthy body gives you the signal, you're going to damage the flesh. You know, the pain is a signal to withdraw your finger. Similarly with, you know, any misuse of the body, the pain is a signal. There's a problem here. You should take care of it. Seen in that light, pain is not something that leads to suffering. It leads to, you welcome it in a sense, as it's a kind of warning. Admittedly, there's a whole aspect of chronic pain, but suffering is much deeper. Suffering is much more something that that comes when you're angry about your circumstances, including pain, emotional pain and physical pain. The ego is outraged that it can't control the body or it can't control circumstances. And that leads to deep suffering. And so it's the switch to soul awareness is extremely helpful, because it means that, firstly, you can recognize pain as a signal requiring you to act in some way or act differently from how you have been. And seen in that positive light, you don't suffer. And secondly, when there is suffering, then again that is like a deeper aspect where the soul itself is not in a state of enlightenment. It's still coming from its ego. And so that's a signal to you, if you're on a spiritual path, that this deep suffering I'm engaged in is also a signal that I need to find a better way forward. That's broadly how I'd answer that one.
You've given us questions which are, some of them are quite deep. I also just want to add to what Neville said that pain is felt by the soul, not the body. The body relates the pain to the soul. Just as memory is in the soul, the intellect is in the soul. You know, since you are talking about this separation between how does the body react and how does the soul react, then it is the soul that does all of those things. The body is the machine that relates everything to the soul. And it's the soul that's perpetual. Soul carries memories. Soul is the one, when you are hypnotized and taken to pre-birthing or anything which the body does not, the memory is not clear, then goes back to the soul to bring that memory back. Coming back to power, most of the conflicts that are going on today, whether they are economic or political or spiritual, although there are no conflicts, well, there are conflicts in spirituality as well, is based on ego. Majority of the conflict is based on ego. Your question is that, are we serious that we understand this, that the real power that is eventually going to solve all these problems is spiritual? Do I understand that correctly?
So, my question is actually relating to the changes that have taken place in the world since the inception of this thought that you generated.
Okay.
On a very strategic issue. A lot is happening. And today you have brought us together after a dialogue in 57 cities to, in a way, sum up and, let us say, you are saying, on your marks, get set and go.
Okay.
So, are we at the go stage prepared to really understand the changes that have taken place? Like I identified a few, ideology, terrorism,
yeah,
climate change, we can add a handful. And are we ready to now act? That means you have prepared us for the battle ahead. Are we prepared to act?
Yes.
And if so, are we really, if we ask ourselves the question, at the individual level, how ready we are, A, B, at the cross-cutting issues level, how prepared we are, C, are we prepared to act as a group or a subgroup?
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
When, as I said, you know, the basis of the future of power was that world power went from Bharat to America. World power is now shifting back to Bharat. We are, when I used to first say that in 2009, when we started this program, I used to get lots of eyebrow raising and saying, really? I think first thing that we've noticed in the last couple of years is that there are hardly any eyebrows being raised anymore. And people are accepting this fact that yes, it's true that power is shifting back to Bharat. Now, the whole process of the future power is that since we want to bring soft power back, Soft power is what we started with. And as it became harder and harder, now that when it comes back, Bharat or India is one of the very few countries in the world that still has a very strong spiritual base in whatever we do, whether it is our custom, our marriages, our going to work in the morning, whatever we do, there is a base of that spirituality still existing. I mean that in a wider sense of the word, because we confuse spirituality and religion. And I always want to separate religion, because that is something very different to what we are talking about. Now, soft power means that I and you and everybody else that we are in connection with is bringing spirituality into their lives, and we are then going ahead and saying, how do you do it? How do you bring spirituality into your life? And so we go into the details of saying, I don't want to give you sorrow. I want to have positive karma. I want to improve my future. I want to improve your future. I don't want to have ego. I don't want to have anger. And so on. All of these things we are bringing into our life. And I can tell you from where we sit, we are getting hundreds of emails from people who have attended the Future Power to say, as a result of this conversation, we have begun to shift the values in our life. We have begun to bring in more and more spirituality into our lives. And this is a very, very positive thing for us. In the process, we are also finding that the Indian sense of spirituality is also going now elsewhere in the world. The very simple example is that Narendra Modi goes out to UN and says, I think we should have a yoga day on the 21st of June. And the whole world just accepts it. And I think that this is the tip of the iceberg of the influence that Bharat is having in the world. And there are lots of other places where the influence is also. Look at how many Indians are now in important positions all over the world. Look at how many Indian companies are now owning of foreign companies. And all of these things is all together proving what we are saying to be right, is that power is shifting back. And what we want to achieve is that power is soft. If you rule over 20,000, by rule I mean have influence over 20,000 people, or 100,000, or 500, doesn't matter. If you are part of this, then that influence is already growing and we can feel this. And I think that is important. I see now, I hear politicians talking the way we talk here. And I see that we are demystifying this whole process of the complications of spirituality. And we want it more and more to separate from religion. Because that we don't want to invoke that. We don't want to get involved in spirituality. Sometimes people say to me, what's a Muslim doing with the Brahma Kumaris? And you know, this is very complicated for them. For me, it's very simple. Because it's not a religion. I don't need to drop something and to adopt something else. This is a way of life. This is teaching me about how to improve the quality of my life. And I am then imparting that and teaching others. So is anybody else. You know, here, we can be four different religions sitting here. It makes no difference. We are all talking the same language. Nobody here comes and say, so, was Krishna right or was Christ right? Or was Buddha right? But it doesn't matter. They were all right in their own way. So I think this message is now going out, that it's universal, because spirituality does not have sections, that is not one part of spirituality I as a Hindu can accept, and one part of spirituality I as a Christian can accept or a Muslim. It makes no difference. It's spiritual, it's universal. So I think this is happening more and more, to answer your question. And I feel that we now need to go international with what we have done. We've only done this in Australia and in Nepal. We are now being requested to do this program in America, North America, which includes Canada. And I think we need to now go with this open and say, that's what we believe. In case you did not know, I'm sorry, I'm going on a bit.
Well, it's okay.
In Australia, we had the High Commissioner for America who attended our program. And he wasn't sitting with us and saying, have you lost your mind? You know, because we were telling him, your country is losing power and power is coming back to the East. What he said was, yes, I understand, based on the arguments, that we are losing power and power is coming back to India. I can live with it. Because if the most important person in the world is an Indian, I can live with that. If the most important person in the world is a Chinese, I would have a problem. But the point I'm trying to make is one of principle. It's not one of, he was not saying no to the shift of the power. He was saying where the power goes was more important to him. So I think the acceptability of what we are saying is, and we can talk about this for hours. I'm sorry if I'm not.
Okay. All right. But I want to get a couple more questions in because we're running out of time.
Just to add one more sentence to that. You know, the COP is going on at the moment in Paris, or maybe it's just finishing. But after what happened in Paris, we have been given the Brahma Kumaris have been given a higher profile, because, you know, when these things happen, like you're speaking about, they can starting to see that spirituality may be able to help, like with climate change. We're involved in so many things, but more and more we're getting recognition. Before they thought, what's spirituality got to do with any of this?
So that's good.
Yeah, we have put a lot of emphasis on thought, you know, creating of thought, slowing down of thought. So what I want to know is, to what extent can thoughts influence the outcomes of, you know, what things are going to happen? Like, for example, I'm expecting a court case judgment. So how much positive thinking would really help in getting, I have a very good case. So how much would positive thinking help in getting a good judgment, or if I think negative, would it really influence? So I want to know the power of thought and how much I can influence the outcomes by my thinking.
I think this is a good one. If I could ask Neville, if you could just briefly talk about what you know, because Neville has actually worked quite a lot in this whole area.
I think I quoted this morning this saying that thought is cause, experience is effect. But that doesn't mean that you can think something into being if it's just because it's something that you'd like. What it does mean is that you would have such a deep conviction about your case that you present it with clarity and with humility, and you would listen, and whatever the outcome, your experience will be determined by the way you think about the case. So if you think in the result of the case, well, I've won and I deserve to win, and I'm really glad that the other person has lost, you might actually be experiencing something that could later lead to a loss for you because of the way you were putting down the other. If, on the other hand, the case went against you, and you know that you did your best, but you accept the outcome and you move on, that is, it's the thinking in those circumstances that is then determining your experience and which is so important. The outcome of the case is less important than your health and happiness. So if you're putting all your efforts into winning this case and then it goes against you, you have actually damaged yourself. That's really important to understand. It's not just a question of thinking things into being because you'd like them. There's something called The Secret that became quite popular, which said that if you think strongly and hard enough, you can get an Aston Martin car or a $5 million home. Maybe you can, but I don't think that is actually something that leads to health and happiness. I think it's more a question of making sure that how you are aligns with those deep qualities of the soul. Because when you act in ways that are against the qualities of the soul, you automatically damage the soul. It's as if you put some rust onto the soul, and your happiness is going to be compromised. There's a saying that I've loved from a Japanese program I used to watch with my children when they were young. Lots of fighting and whatnot, you know, they're set in ancient Japan, and they finished with one of these episodes: when evil is fought with evil, only evil can win. So you really have to make sure that all your motivation is good, then inevitably you're going to be the winner, whatever the outcome out there.
Okay, and sir, yeah. And then ma'am, afterwards.
I just wanted to share my own experience in brief. I belong to Indian Administrative Service, joined in 1975. Soon after, I faced a dilemma. The kind of religion I was brought in never influenced me. I was least impressed by it. I was on the right way, right path, without knowing why. So in one of the farewell meetings, a good friend suggested me, "Mr. Mittal, you work with lot of values, but will repent later, because values don't work." This question took me in a very strange manner, and I bent upon knowing the science of values. I studied almost all the scriptures, came across several organizations, including Brahma Kumaris, and then arrived at the conclusion that values are strength, they are never weakness. And this I experienced in my long administrative service, irrespective of which government is, which department you are in, and with whom you work, you are always have been happy and successful. And this motivated me to form a mission, which Mr. Duma was inquiring in the noon, a mission to develop positive thinking. I didn't call it spiritual thinking, because that was the time when the spiritual world used to repel persons. And ultimately it is this positive thinking, which is, you can say, value-based thinking. Or so I think this works. The dilemma, the myth that values don't work, is going fast, but more has to be. There are success stories. Delhi Metro is only a creation of values. Mr. E. Sridhar is a highly spiritual person. Wipro is an example. Tatas are example. I think Tatas giving bribe is something not known at all. And I think there are large number of companies we are doing financially very well, working on value system. I think this message needs to be spread fast, and I think this is happening. Small incident, I was president of Lucknow Management Association. We had invited a Nobel laureate for a talk, and in that talk there were a lot of comparisons between India and China, and in most of the comparisons China was above India. So when we were having lunch informally, I asked him, "Sir, in every parameters you mentioned China is above India, but can you think of any parameter where India is above China?" He said, "It's a very interesting inquiry. Let me think for a minute." And after a pause, he said, "Yes, I think it is happiness where India is much above China. You know, what else do we need? Ultimately, all growth is for happiness. And if India is getting it cheap, I don't see it as a bad proposition." Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Okay, hold on a sec, because we've got a sister over there. Yes, ma'am. Yep. Yep, it's you. And then you, Rita. Okay, and then this gentleman here. And then, you know, I want to tell you, we're out of time. So at the moment, Aruna is somewhere here who's going to be taking a session, and she's worrying. So really just a minute of comment, and then we'll move to the next scene. Okay.
Thank you. I have a very simple curiosity that science has been like spirituality is like this morning we learn about spirituality and science. I like to know, is there, like we are talking about the God is always above, yeah? So has science has been done any experimental or research on above? What is that? So that is my question.
Okay. Where is above?
Yes.
Okay.
What is there?
Okay,
is
let's
another.
Oh, no, you're only allowed one. Sorry, I got to be tough. Okay. We're going to very short answer. Nev, God above.
In a manner of speaking, it's helpful to us to, it's like elevated thinking. We speak of high thinking. But actually, it's, as I mentioned this morning, it's not a place. God is in the ground of being, and God is a soul, an individual soul, who is beyond this drama. So it's beyond rather than above, I would say, fits more accurately the current thinking among these frontier scientists who've recognized that the world is run on consciousness and who are wondering, as one of them I quoted, if there isn't a source of that, of this great drama, this great informational drama, a source which might be God.
Okay. And Rita, yeah.
Well, to the earlier Mr. Hoskinson's conversation regarding bringing up children, I personal experience, my grandmother used to say that one should not beat a child till he's 5 years old, because till then the brain is growing. That was her scientific or rational logic. And that was 40 years back, only fifth standard educated. But I think that is the power of India, that now in third generation also, when I experiment with that, I find my children more open to things. And around me, I see a lot of parents hitting their children for very petty things. Mm. I think that, again, a way of soft power that we should develop. And
yeah.
This FOP thing, what we take back with us is more important, because unless we implement on ourselves, we can't tell the world that you are going to do this or this is going to work. This is the FOP thing. When we take to our workplace or corporate or wherever, like last FOP 1 year back when I attended, Mr. Nizar's 10 commandments, he said, cook for your children. A mother should cook for her children. I started 1 year back. Today I'm taking one DVD also, Brahma Kumari's cooking. And I think Jaisa Ann Vaisa Mann is what I'm taking back. And maybe once I spread around, it would make a little difference, maybe to 20 people, 50 people,
right.
Not be to a big corporate.
Okay.
Another thing I learned this time,
Let's leave it there, because we're going to have to finish very soon. Sir, you put your hand up.
But Brahma Kumaris, when we went to this Pandaval, there people were writing things and putting in that kutia. But
yes.
Yesterday what we were taught was that thought to thought connection hona chahiye. I did not understand the logic of writing.
I don't know. Well, I'd never do that.
No, but she'll give the answer.
Yeah.
She'll give you the answer.
Sir.
What is the basis of making four divisions of time cycle 1250 years each? What I mean to say, the soul is at full power, it is degrading, one cycle is enough. Why four divisions?
Okay. Now that is a technical question requiring at least, half an hour's answer. What I'm going to do is refer you to Neville, who will talk to you over supper and satisfy your every thought. And if he won't answer you, I will.
Actually, I was going to
say. Yeah, I can do it. No problem. We got a date. Now, if I get Aruna to come up here, will you be satisfied? Will it be okay? Can I have your permission to ask Aruna to come? Because, the wrath of you versus the wrath of Aruna. I have to weigh these up, you see. I know Aruna. I know, she's lovely. So, thank you very much. What's been lovely is that we've been able to have this conversation. Thank you. And we'll now leave the stage, and I invite Aruna to come to do the next program. And well, okay, thank you very much. Om Shanti.